it's extraordinary. I've been sitting in the audience looking this way, and one can see the speakers, but I can't see any of you because I'm looking straight into the light. But I've got to remember there are people down there. Now, my name is Max, excuse me, my name is Max Corden. I'm a retired elderly professor of economics. And being elderly, I think I'm entitled to make one or two autobiographical remarks before I introduce the speaker. 44 years ago, I had been in Australia, and I came to Oxford. Now, it's typical for Australians in those days, and perhaps for Indians, to hold anything in England, particularly Oxford, with great awe. And I was very nervous about going to Oxford and teaching there. I went to Nuffield College, which is the same college where the Prime Minister got his Dr. Phil. And I'm not talking about the Australian Prime Minister. And I expected that the students in Oxford would be brilliant, all of them, highly verbal, we'll call it talkative, and extremely self-confident. And I wasn't particularly self-confident, being Australian, coming from a former colony of Britain. And I think perhaps some Indians felt the same way when they came to Oxford. Anyway, one of the things that happened, in the very first term, there were a lot of students, and there was one student who was indeed brilliant, talkative, or highly verbal, and extremely self-confident. And he was Indian. And his name was Montak Ahluwalia Singh, the husband of today's speaker. And I can just imagine, when I tell you about today's speaker, what breakfast must be like in Delhi, the two of them. Well, now, the truth is, if I was to give you an account of our today's speaker's record, it would take the whole time. I'm taking away valuable time. So I would just like to say our today's speaker is Isha Judge Ahluwalia, who happens by chance, of course, you know, to be the wife of this brilliant student. But imagine two of them together. It's most impressive. I've known her for a long time. I will tell you that if you go to Google and type in her, and I'm sure all of you being Indians or Australians use the computer and know what I mean by Google, you go to Google and type in her full name, up comes a lot of information. The shortcut would be to go to Wikipedia. And there it all is, all the things I would be telling you. For example, she's won a prize from the President of India. She's won a prize for the best book on the economy of India. She's held innumerable positions. She's on many committees. And obviously, it must be a very agreeable person, because people keep on putting her on committees. She's also on, not only on Indian committees, but she's also on a whole lot of international committees based in Washington and elsewhere. So I'm not going to read it out, because you can look it up yourself. But I'd just like to say that this is the valedictory lecture on India's economic history. The precise title is India's Economic Story, From Nehru to Manmohan Singh. So I introduce Isha.
Thank you, Max. You spent 5 minutes talking about my husband and 2 minutes about me. But you are excused, because professors are supposed to be partial to their students. And Amitabh, thank you very much for inviting me to this conference. I'm delighted to be here as chair of the International Advisory Committee of the Institute. I'm really happy to see feel sorry that I missed yesterday because of something unavoidable in Delhi. Professor Max Corden has many students and admirers in India, and of course, most especially my husband, who often talks of him. So this obviously is a mutual admiration club that they belong to. To talk on the Indian economy from Jawaharlal Nehru to Manmohan Singh is a formidable task. So I have to be selective, and I'm basically going to speak of some highlights of this period, which to me are the most important from an economist's point of view. As you all know, Jawaharlal Nehru was the first Prime Minister of India, and he remained the elected leader in that position until he passed away in 1964. He was a modernizer who wanted to transform India from a poor economy which had suffered from the neglect of the colonial rule and transform it into a modern industrial nation. Like many of his contemporary leaders of other developing countries, he was a socialist and an internationalist. He understood the multiple challenges that India faced in the process of social and economic development and was in search for a model that would work. He was convinced of the significant economic potential of India, and he believed in India's ability to act as a major power to influence the global economic and political environment. He started the non-aligned movement because he did not want India to align itself with one superpower or the other. In that sense, you could say that in today's language, he would be he was a forerunner of what we will call a proponent of strategic autonomy for a nation. Nehru's socialism was not very different from Labour parties in Britain at the time. He believed that the state had to play a major role in economic development. He doubted the ability of the private sector to transform the economy as rapidly as was necessary, and he was deeply suspicious of unbridled market forces. He wanted a strong public sector which could guide and regulate the private sector. He wanted the presence of a dominant public sector to put a check on what would otherwise emerge from private activity. Now, these ideas were actually fairly common in the 1950s and 1960s among leaders of developing countries. What was unusual for the times was his commitment to democracy. He worked hard to build an institutional framework for democracy in India. And in many ways, India's adherence to democratic principles and values over all these years owes a great deal to Nehru's crucial leadership in the early years of our independence. Now, on the economy, Nehru obviously wanted the economy to grow rapidly. In fact, several years before we attained our political independence, the Indian National Congress had set up a National Planning Committee under Jawaharlal Nehru in 1938. Because their work was interrupted by the Second World War, there is no published report of that committee that is available, but there are documents to suggest that the committee was thinking along the lines that India's national wealth should be targeted to double or treble every 10 years. Now, if you translate that into today's language, that amounts to targeting for an annual growth rate of GDP from somewhere from 7% to 11%. And it's only in the last decade that we have begun to achieve that target. So that tells you on, you know, on the economic front, you know, how far we are from where the National Planning Committee wanted us to be. We are nowhere close to 11%. The lackluster economic growth of about 3.5% per annum during Nehru's own period continued pretty much till the end of the 1970s. In fact, in a decade and a half after Nehru, the regulatory regime was tightened, the economy became even more close to foreign competition, and the old industrial and trade policy regime, with all this further tightening, had little to show for itself in terms of the results. The major highlight of that period from 1965 to 1980 really was Prime Minister Indira Gandhi's bold decision to launch the Green Revolution, which changed the course of Indian agriculture for better. For the economy as a whole, things began to change only in the 1980s, and Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi played a major role in modernizing the outlook on the economy. Now, it's true that by then, India, thanks to its old regime, had set up a very diversified industrial base and also had a private sector which was very active in its own way. So we had an energetic private sector existing in the economy. This reminds me of once in the early 90s at our institute, we had a seminar, and there was a Russian economist who was visiting us, and as somebody was talking, they mentioned the word that, you know, we are really a mixed economy, and then started to explain what our mixed economy meant with the coexistence of the public and the private sector. And before he could finish, the Russian economist interrupted and said, yes, yes, I know what that means. You are a confused economy. You know, so this is what we were struggling with. But by the time Rajiv Gandhi had come on the stage, there were several years, including Janata government, and when Indira Gandhi returned to power, that the need for the frustration with the old regime and the need to look for a change was already there. And what Rajiv Gandhi did was to push for modern infrastructure, emphasize the role of IT, telecommunications, and also what he's less known for, worked very hard to bring about decentralization within our federal framework. But even as the language was beginning to change on the policy front, it was very difficult to bring about change on the ground because the old mindsets take their own time and the country was not really quite ready for a radical change. I always like giving this comparison between China and India. As you all know, China really began its reforms in 1978, and between 1978 and 1991, China had doubled its GDP. In India, we started talking of reform in the late 70s when the Janata government came to power. A lot of committees were set up, including insiders and outsiders, and it was very clear that most people agreed that the old instruments were not delivering. But because we are a democracy, because we had a dominant public sector, because we have a vibrant private sector and an open media, and we are more than a billion argumentative Indians, it took us all those years from 1978 to 1991, and that too with a crisis thrown in, to develop the political will to bring about a change. It is not that we were not aware of what was happening in China. We were watching the consequences of action on the policy front when China was doing its U-turn on economic policies. We were, I think, in addition to the balance of payments crisis of 1991, what made a big difference was when we saw the consequences of inaction on the part of Soviet Union. I think that also had a major impact in developing the political will to finally get the job going. And this fell on the on Prime Minister Narasimha Rao to bite the bullet and bring about the change. And before I talk of 1991, I should say here that during the 1980s, while Rajiv Gandhi had started a process of market orientation, we were moving away from physical controls to market-oriented instruments, and there was simplification on the trade policy front. Essentially, two things did not change. The public sector remained as dominant as ever, and the economy remained as closed as ever. But even with these hesitant experiments in the direction of market orientation, we found that the growth rate of GDP, which was about 3.5% per annum in the first three decades, increased to 5.5% per annum in the 80s, which actually made the reformers in the 1990s bolder in attempting a more radical change. However, the problem in the 1980s was that while we were doing a structural cleanup job, the macroeconomy of India was becoming more and more fragile, because this was a period when export subsidies, agricultural subsidies, and a number of other expenditures like those on account of modernizing defense really led to spiraling fiscal deficits. And many economists were warning that we will not be able to sustain this higher growth rate. And then came the Gulf War, and that was the last straw. And as I said, by that time, the example of China and the disintegrated Soviet Union was also before us. And this was the time when Prime Minister Narasimha Rao brought the technocrat Dr. Manmohan Singh as finance minister into his government. Manmohan Singh had been a civil servant and had worked in the government in practically all the important economic positions. In fact, many would say that he had helped craft the whole intricate policy regime. So in that sense, by the time it was very clear that that would not work, he knew what the levers were, how to bring about a change, and what exactly it was that required fixing. As I mentioned earlier on, in the 1980s, the economy had remained closed and the public sector was dominant. What the new government in 1991 did under Prime Minister Narasimha Rao's leadership was to become bolder on domestic deregulation and at the same time take a radical step to begin to dismantle a highly protective regime which really limited imports coming into the economy. This meant bringing down the tariff rates in a slow and steady manner and dismantle the quantitative restrictions or regime of dismantle the regime of quantitative restrictions through import licensing. It's very important to note that while these reforms began in 1991, from 1991 to 2004, we have had a number of political parties and their permutations and combinations in different coalitions at the center as well as in different states that have carried these reforms forward. Admittedly, in a haphazard manner, and India is the kind of society where, as I mentioned earlier on, given how noisy we are, sometimes it's very difficult to separate noise from signal. The same party, when it is in power, is doing the right thing. But when it is out of power, it tries to make it difficult for those who are in power to do the right thing. But the direction has been set. The political competition is in differentiating the product. But the fact that you need to make your economy more market-oriented, the need that you want to integrate with the world economy in order to accelerate economic growth and make a dent on poverty, that I think is universally recognized across party lines. Perhaps the left parties would not openly admit it, but privately even they realize that you cannot have redistribution or poverty alleviation without growth. In 2004, Mrs. Sonia Gandhi, president of the Congress Party, got Manmohan Singh elected as the head of the Congress-led coalition government, which came into power that year. So now let me turn to the performance. As I mentioned, the first three decades were decades of very indifferent economic performance, and we began to change our ways to achieve higher growth in the 1980s. Now, if you look at the next three decades, which really is the second half of the 60-year period about which you have asked me to talk, there is evidence of substantial improvement in economic performance during this period. Indian economy has made a phenomenal transition from the bottom of the growth heap in the first three decades after independence to one of the fastest growing economies of the world today. From an average growth of less than 4% per annum in those three decades, the growth in the last decade was over 8% per annum, and the preceding two decades about 5.5% per annum growth of GDP. Now, if you look at the population growth, which was 2% per annum in the first three decades and has now come down to about 1.5% per annum, you are talking about an economy which was growing its per capita income at 2% per year in the first three decades and has now moved in the last decade to really increase per capita income at the rate of 6.5% per annum. Now, that's a huge change, and the economists among you who are sitting here would immediately understand what it involves in terms of structural transformation, the increasing share of industry and services. But before I go to that, let me also give you the numbers on the poverty front. In the first three decades, the percentage of population in poverty, as defined officially, fluctuated around 50%. Today, this percentage has come down to about 25%. But as argumentative Indians, we are still debating on whether the measure of poverty is right or not. And indeed, whether the measure is right or not, if you define poverty more broadly to include the deprivation of basic needs such as basic education, basic health, food security, public service delivery of water and sanitation, etc., there is no doubt that poverty would be much larger than the 25%. And indeed, as a country growing at 8% per annum, now, we should also raise our aspirations to set a higher benchmark by which to judge our success. But the distinguishing feature, if you look at our economic policies and performance, the distinguishing feature of India has been that all this has been accomplished in a federal regime where both the center and the states have acted and in a democratic framework. Naturally, when you go towards market orientation and decentralization, you will see that some states would be forging ahead faster than others, and the same was true for India. It was mostly the states of the South which got the message first. But the data again show that in the last decade, after all, a number of those weak and so-called backward states like Bihar, Madhya Pradesh, Orissa, Rajasthan have also caught up in accelerating their growth, and there is no state which in the last 5 years has grown at less than 6% per annum. So what is my overall assessment? I've already talked about growth and poverty. The major problem today, let me first talk about agriculture, because I've not said much about that so far, other than the Green Revolution. The Green Revolution brought about a certain change in our agriculture by providing a new agricultural strategy, which required both providing extension services to the farmers and subsidized seeds and all the other inputs. However, by the time we started working on the industrial and trade policy regime in the 1980s, we also needed a rethink on agriculture to see whether the farmers still needed that subsidy for fertilizers, because they had seen the value of the fertilizer in improving the yield. Now, here the decade of the 1980s actually saw fertilizer subsidies really increasing. And the irony is that the subsidy did not even go to the farmer as much as it went to the inefficient Indian industry. Through our policy of fertilizer production in the public sector, through our policy of import controls and tariffs, we first raised the price of fertilizer, then lowered it to the farmer by providing a subsidy. And the result was that while the inputs were being subsidized, public investment in agriculture really declined because the resources were misdirected towards subsidies rather than investment. The second problem with Indian agriculture was that we were so preoccupied with food security and food self-sufficiency and interpreted that in terms of food grains, that agricultural policy did not really go beyond wheat and rice. And the focus of agriculture was on those and maybe one or two other food grains. In today's India, as per capita incomes are rising and demand for lentils, vegetables, fruit, dairy products is rising, we find that we really need to have a very close look at our agricultural policy, deliberately provide incentives to diversify away from food grains, and also worry about sustainability. Because many of these fertilizers that are being provided at a subsidized rate, they end up really taking away micronutrients from the soil. So I think we need a lot that needs to happen on the agricultural front. But some rethinking, 1990s was a very bad period for agriculture. And in the last 10 years, we have been looking at the government of India, along with the state governments coming together, have been looking at the agricultural policies. And two things that have received a lot of attention are, one, water, which because of, for a number of reasons that I would not go into, the water table was going down. 80% of water in India is used in agriculture and used very inefficiently. So there has been now a lot of work done in this area, a lot of public investment in water harvesting, irrigation, which is beginning to show a difference, and the growth rate of agriculture in the last 5 years has been close to 4%, 3.8% or so. And there have been some success stories, particularly with BT cotton, maize and basmati rice. So we have begun the task, but we have a long way to go to really get our agricultural strategy right. Another indication of doing better in agriculture is that we've reduced the vulnerability of agriculture, and there is a degree of resilience in Indian agriculture today. 2009 was a very major drought year, and the agricultural growth rate was 0.5%. Normally, in a major drought year, agricultural growth would go down by 6%, 7%, 8%. So, obviously, through all these policies of providing irrigation and water strategies, some degree of resilience is coming into Indian agriculture. Now, let me talk of the challenges ahead, because it all the way I have presented it, it might seem to you as if it's all a very happy story and that there aren't any problems. There are some problems because some areas were not attended to. There are other problems which are a second generation problem coming because something was fixed and it led to something else. And then there are some problems that have come from the fact that we are now a well-integrated economy with the global economy. So anything that happens in the world economy has an impact on us. So what are the challenges ahead? The first is to sustain this high growth rate that we have achieved in the last 10 years, 8%, 8.5%, and the latest plan is talking of setting the target. It has just been approved. The target has been approved at 9% per annum in the plan that begins next year. But this is something which by no means can just be assumed that it will be done unless a whole lot of things are done. And one of the major areas of concern is the macroeconomic situation once again. I mentioned to you that in 1991, when the balance of payments crisis happened, even without the balance of payment crisis, we were heading in a direction of fiscal profligacy, and the center and states put together had a gross fiscal deficit of about 9.2%. It looks as if we are heading in the same direction. Now, admittedly, we have 300 billion of foreign exchange reserves as opposed to $1 billion of foreign exchange reserves then, but in this frantic and fragile world of foreign exchange reserves, no amount is adequate if the perception is that the policies are not going the right way. And the short-term debt as a proportion of total debt is also rising. And these are, you know, cause for concern. The other concern is that while the growth rate of GDP has been high and it has been sustained, it has not been associated with a high growth rate of employment. And this has to do partly with our labor laws and our labor policies, which have really discouraged the labor-intensive manufacturing sector from doing well. But this also has to do with the fact that a lot of employment is in the unorganized sector. And this is something which would require another seminar for me to go into, but the low employment elasticity of Indian economic growth is a cause of major concern and calls for social protection. if we really need to make this growth inclusive. That is one way of looking at it at one end. The other way of looking at it is that if you want more greater employment, if you want more productive jobs for our young labor force, then you really need to invest in skills, in education. And this is an area which we had not thought about much, because for a long time we used to take pride in the fact that we have all these Indian Institutes of Technologies and Indian Institutes of Management and Indian Institutes of Science, and we have so many engineers and so many this and that. All of that was good enough for a 5% per annum growth rate, and that was good enough to scare the U.S. With our IT professionals, but it's not good enough when India begins to grow at 8% per annum. And this is now being recognized, and both through government efforts and through public-private partnership, there is a lot of emphasis on higher education and particularly skill development, for which Australia really offers a tremendous opportunity, and I hope that this institute really brings this thing to a further stage where we can actually gain from the enormous experience that Australia has in vocational training, etc. There is some encouraging news in the latest employment survey that just became available a few months ago, but given the dimensions of the problem and given the fact that we have 50% of our population of working age, and as the preceding speaker also mentioned, that you know we have a rising, we are on that sweet spot in our demographic curve where we could actually reap this dividend. But the other side of the same coin is that if we don't educate our youth and if we don't empower them with human capital, this could become a demographic disaster. The idea is to really, in one way, we've had, when I was talking of agriculture, I should have mentioned that in the social protection phase, the present government has started, and it's now countrywide, the National Rural Employment Guarantee Scheme, which is very good in what it does if there are indeed that many people who are poor and who require jobs. But we have to keep reminding ourselves that this is not a long-term solution. In the long term, these people have to be educated, provided with opportunities of productive jobs, so that they can really contribute to an accelerating growth rate, which can give better standards of living for all Indians. The other day I was talking to a friend about this structural transformation, and she said something which made me thinking that we economists sometimes just take it for granted. When I said that if you want to grow at 8% per annum, you really have to invest in more productive jobs in industry and services. And she said, surely that's a matter of choice. Why can't we keep them in agriculture? So then I had to explain to her how the most that agriculture has grown in any country for a sustained period has been at the rate of 4.5% or so. And if what we need is an 8 to 10% growth to improve the lot of a whole lot of poor people in our country, 4.5% is not good enough. And that is why we need to really work on this employment front. The next challenge, which I will not talk about very much because it has been talked about for a long time and it still remains a challenge, is the challenge of building infrastructure for a modern economy, whether it is electricity or telecommunications, roads, ports, airports. Today, there is evidence that in some of these sectors, we've made a lot of progress. In the process, we've also created a lot of problems. What is very clear is that there are large sums involved, and there is need for independent regulators, and this is a job which government alone cannot do, so you will have to have public-private partnership. But if you are going the PPP way, then you have to have transparent mechanisms of awarding these contracts. And there has been a lot of, today when I looked at the Australian newspaper, looking at your newspapers is really, it feels like being at home, because it always seems like there are one scandal after another opening. And we've had a lot of that in the infrastructure sectors. But in telecommunications, at least, with all the problems on the regulation front, we have actually made a difference, where today the IT can be used in so many ways, not only to improve the bottom lines of big fat companies, as people used to say, but actually to improve governance in public service delivery. And this brings me to the area that most preoccupies me these days, and that is the challenge of the urban sector. We in India have 31% of our population living in urban areas today, which is much, much lower than any other country that we would like to compare ourselves with. Some of us believe that this may even be a matter of definition, and actually the numbers are larger than that. But another way of looking at it is that when we did not have very rapid growth, the rural to urban migration was really limited. And now that we are into the 8% growth, we could not even provide for the limited migration that came to the cities of India. And the state of public service delivery in our cities, whether it is drinking water or sewerage or storm water drains or solid waste management, wastewater treatment, it is abysmal, to say the least. And the good news is that 5 years ago, the government started a National Urban Renewal Mission, Jawaharlal Nehru National Urban Renewal Mission, in which the states and the government of India and the cities had to come together, city governments had to come together to get funding under the scheme and fix some of these very basic services that, you know, that I've talked about. And after 7 years, this was started 7 years ago, this National Urban Renewal Mission comes to an end next March, and in fact, as soon as I get back, we have a major seminar where I present the report that I had the privilege to head for the Ministry of Urban Development, where we are sharing these findings with state-level officials. I've already presented this to the Government of India ministers and to 6 chief ministers of different states. The message that comes across, and why I say this at some length, is because this is very important that we probably have something that we can learn from Australia in urban infrastructure development and public service delivery as well, because we have a situation where the responsibility for these functions has been transferred via a constitutional amendment to our urban local governments. But the funding, but these mandates basically remain unfunded, because the constitution was very ambivalent about how state governments will provide funding for this to the city governments. And it essentially boils down to a major governance reform where accountability for these services must rest with the urban local governments, and funding should also be mandatorily transferred to them, as in the case of South Africa, where they have guaranteed predictable transfers to local governments to attend to these jobs. Why I think it is so important is because I feel that we in India for a long time have believed that India lives in villages. And we are still not really, there's a bit of a denial and a bit of sort of this wish that we should really go back to the rural areas and not come and crowd the cities. At the same time, for the road that we have set out on, cities will be the engines of growth. So we need to really empower these cities, endow these cities, and bring about the governance reforms so that we can actually have cities act as centers of agglomeration, which can provide an environment in which innovation can take place. We economists often talk about an investment climate to attract private investment. And when we say that, we normally look at ease of doing business. And now, in terms of ease of doing business, we've made a lot of progress. We haven't quite got there, but investors will tell you that they get their clearances much faster than they did earlier on. But there's also the ease of living, the comfort of living in these cities. And I think for that, what we need really is to develop a strategy which emphasizes rural-urban connectivity and rural-urban synergy rather than a rural-urban divide, which has really been the way we have looked at it. What was very clear from our work in the urban sector was that there are 5 or 6 states which are way ahead compared to the other states in urban service delivery. And these are states which have first created an enabling environment for the third tier of government to function. And second, they have also built capacity at the local government level. The argument for the center not really forcing or nudging the states to transfer responsibility is that there isn't capacity at the city level. But the truth is that since people are becoming more and more aware of their rights, there is empowerment, and we are talking of need for transparency and accountability. That can really be done best when you can see your local government official in the city in which you are to claim your rights. And I'm sure you have all seen on your television sets the Anna Hazare campaign that was against corruption. Now, corruption has been at all levels in our country, as it is in many countries. But the truth is that in this case, when you actually talk to people of why they were going to join in this protest, everyone had their own story to tell. So this was really someone that I don't get my drinking water, somebody that, you know, look at the fact that my street lights are not there, or somebody else talking about, you know, they were not talking about the big corruption which was separately going on. So I think if we really need to make progress and sustain this high growth rate, we really have to fix our cities so that they can do this work of so they can act as engines of growth. In a democracy, it's you do all these things and you are working against time, because as you do something which shows results, people naturally get more aspirational. And with the telecommunication revolution, you actually see what is going on in the rest of the world. And you want to compare. The benchmark is no longer what you got yesterday. But if Malaysia can do it, if Indonesia can do it, why not we? So what you are seeing today is a resurgent India, a youthful India, a more self-confident India. There was a time when we had only the non-resident Indians in the U.S. which could confidently talk of their contribution to the U.S. economy. Since then, it's not just the IT sector in India that has done wonders for the Indian corporate sector, and now the Indian governance structures, both at the state level and the center, but also other industries have come up. Our industrialists are now not just thinking in terms of India as their play field. They're investing in Europe, they're investing in the US, they're investing in Australia. So it's really the world is their play field in which they are acting. And that's the mood that India is willing to engage globally. Gone are the times when we used to think of the WTO as the devil. Today, we know that what goes on in the world's international institutions has an effect on us. So we want to shape the environment of which we will be a part. And this engagement with BRICS, with IBSA, with G20 is all a reflection of this realization that we are part of this big wide world. And if multilateral trade negotiations have collapsed, the way to do is to go for free trade agreements. And if the industrialized West is collapsing, the way out is to look east. And I am actually a part of an eminent persons group that has been set up, which is for ASEAN and India economic cooperation. So today, it is really, we need our space, we need our strategic autonomy, and we need to build, we need to realize our economic potential, which for long has just been there, and maybe the external factors were responsible a little bit, but a lot of it has to do with what we have to fix. And what we need to do is harness our energy to really be able to deliver to the rising aspirations of our youth. Thank you.
First of all, I want to thank Isha, obviously. I thought that was fantastic and also should make one feel very optimistic about India. I had another thought that I would like to pass on. You know, the profession of economics, of which we are both part of, and your husband, of course, we are often treated with some doubt, let's put it this way, not entirely polite. Every crisis that arises is usually attributed to the economists, just like doctors are blamed for all the people who die in hospitals, for example. But the truth is, a talk like this shows not only the importance of economics, but the usefulness of economics in the basis of prosperity. And India has shown, by its experience so far, what difference it makes to follow good, sound, orthodox economic policies. And there will be more of them, particularly if Isha's in charge. So I really think it's wonderful. Thank you very much. Now, do we have time for questions? Are you going to say something? Okay, right. Are you going to say more good things?
Thank you very much, Max. And I really also want to, on behalf of the Australia India Institute, thank Isha for her extraordinary speech, which I found absolutely insightful in that linking of economics, social change, social challenges, environmental aspects, and really policy, the policy for India's development. I do have also a Max Corden anecdote, which I will add. He had one other student, which has been mentioned a couple of times during the talk, who I believe is unrelated to Isha Ahluwalia, and that's Manmohan Singh, the current Prime Minister of India, who went into some of your classes in Oxford, as I understand.
Before my time,
I didn't. No, you didn't supervise him, but I think the Max Corden influence is there and is considerable. So for us also, it's a great pleasure to have Max and Isha on the stage together. I can also add, if I could, just one extra comment about Isha. And she has a PhD from MIT. Now, in my science background, MIT is up there with Oxford. So at the same time as being anxious about Oxford, I can imagine being anxious about being at MIT. It's been a privilege, I think, for all of us to hear this talk, and particularly to recognise the contribution that economists and economic planners can have in important social policy issues for the development of their community and their society. I'd ask you now if you could to thank Isha for a wonderful presentation, and then I'll have a few little comments to close. Thank you very much. So again, just briefly, it's been a wonderful and stimulating 2 days. As I know from all the chatter that I've heard, is widely understood and widely agreed. So for me, I was trying to work out an analogy to kind of bring this wonderful event to a close, and so I had to retreat into my background in chemistry. And it seemed to me that the chemistry is right. If the economics know how to do it, but the chemistry is right between Australia and India. And the Australia-India Institute is pleased to be part of that chemistry, that reaction. The speakers, I thought, were our reagents, as were our wonderful audience. And the chief alchemist now is, and actually will change his title from director to chief alchemist, Professor Matu, for bringing all the reagents together. And I'd also acknowledge the assistant alchemists at the Institute who've worked with our chief alchemist to bring off this wonderful conference. And although it technically finishes here as a conference, a couple of things I'd remind you. Those of you who have been on the stage have been blinded by the lights. Those of you who have been in the audience have been perhaps overwhelmed by them. But they were there for a purpose, and that was to film the proceedings of the conference. So we will be publishing not just the audio, but also the video of the conference. There will also be a monograph coming out from the conference over the next few months. We plan to launch that monograph or have it ready at our next conference, which will be in Kolkata in early December. So this is part of a major series of events which the Institute has undertaken. I'd ask you all to look for our electronic newsletter on our website, and to remember that there is another major event for the Institute on Monday evening, the oration of the Australia-India Institute for this year, which will be given by MP Shashi Tharoor from India, a wonderful speaker and raconteur, and has been engaged in both international policy work at the UN and for the government of India, and will talk about soft power and public diplomacy. So thank you very much, everyone, for being with us over these last couple of days. The record for it will be out, both written, visual, audio, and we look forward to an occasion next year when we could welcome you to another Australia-India conference. Thank you very much.